we might have to because we talk about bee honey, then we talk about eggs, and then the next thing that it leads to is milk. Can you take milk from an unkosher animal? And you know I'm referring to the verse in Bereshit that talks about the milking camels that Yaakov gave to Esau, right?
Yeah, I think you're going to be able to make two programs out of this one at this rate. So milk. Milk. We don't eat anything that comes from unkosher animals if it actually comes from the animal's body. Is this really from the animal's body? Okay. Which will raise a question about the bee saliva. Yes. There's bee saliva in this.
No, yes.
Yuck. But yeah. There's bee saliva in this. So it's a good question. I mean, really, it is a very, very good question. Are we allowed to eat bee honey? We don't eat milk from non-kosher animals. This is why, for example, milk has a serious there's a lot of supervision on the issue of milk in Israel. People don't even eat milk that was milked by a non-Jew who's milked his own cows, unless it's in the United States, because the United States is a federal law and you can actually be shut down and fined for this. But if you mix anything in besides cow milk into the milk, it is completely illegal. So here in Israel, for example, you find these packages and say this doesn't have the ultra-Orthodox kosher certificate on it because it comes from, say, milk or milk powder, which was produced by people who are not Jewish without Jewish supervision, or with Jewish supervision, but it was only partial supervision. And so ultra-Orthodox and a lot of Orthodox people don't eat this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still considered to be kosher because it does come from a cow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is a rabbinical decree that you're not allowed to eat milk that wasn't milked in front of a Jew, because to make sure it's actually from a cow and not from a non-kosher animal. So, for example, camel's milk, and there's this whole thing about camel's milk presumably being very healthy. The thing is, I actually know someone who had to drink camel milk to take over an ulcer, a very serious ulcer in their stomach.
Uh-huh.
And what this person said was that the camel's milk has such a distinct flavor that there is no way on earth that if you drink a cow's milk with camel's milk, they would not feel the difference.
Right.
And this was the experience. They said it has such a powerful flavor. If you mix it in, you'll be able to taste it.
So this brings us, Yoel, to Bereshit, Genesis 32, verse 15. Esau comes to meet Yaakov, and Yaakov brings all these the gifts for him to placate him, okay? And he arrives, and he's got, in verse 15, it mentions 30 milk camels with their colts. Now, is this just saying, and then it goes on to say 40 cows and bulls and so on and so forth.
Okay, so first of all, it says menikot. Menikot means that they're breastfeeding. It doesn't mean that they're milk,
uh-huh,
that you milk them.
Uh-huh.
Menikot, because if it meant milking, it would said cholvot, from the word chalav.
Uh-huh.
Cholvot, lachlov, the verb lachlov, is to milk. Okay. The word here is menikot, which means that they're still feeding their children.
So they're camels in milk, not camels for milk.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. So if we're already talking about milk and something with children, another very interesting topic, the issue of meat and milk. I was actually wanting to avoid this topic.
We can't avoid this. So everybody wants to know what you think, Yoel. We're looking at Deuteronomy 14, verse 21. Deuteronomy 14.
Okay, so it actually appears, and my guess is that everyone out there has heard this explanation, and specifically from a very, very specific person. If anyone knows who I'm talking about, they'll recognize him. Should I mention his name or not?
Sure, mention his name. You can mention his name.
Okay, so everyone, I guess that almost everyone who listens to these programs also knows who Nehemiah Golden is. Mm-hmm. I actually know Nehemiah. We're good friends. He is a wonderful person. He has extremely vast knowledge, and he actually talks about this topic in a video he made,
yes,
which was one of the first videos I actually saw by him, and I remember when I actually physically met him, because funny enough, he lives here in Israel,
mm-hmm,
and he's in Israel most of the time, and we meet up a lot, and we become very good friends, and he's become one of the people I study with a lot.
Sure.
We meet up every once in a while and study a lot, and he's donated a lot of his knowledge and his time for me. And he's clarified a lot of issues, biblical issues, things that, you know, even being a Hebrew teacher, the things are not 100% clear. And he has a lot of background and a lot of knowledge, and he has 2 degrees, and has it also to do with linguistics a bit, and archaeology, and there's a lot of information he points out.
Sure.
So this, the issue of the, to boil, to sear a goat in his mother's milk,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to give a brief explanation what the verse actually means and what's actually practiced in rabbinical Judaism. First of all, this appears 3 times. It appears when it talks about the festivals. It appears twice when it talks about the festivals in the book of. It appears once in the book of Numbers, once in the book of Leviticus, and then another time it appears in the book of Deuteronomy. Two of the times it appears when it appears in. Let's be very, very precise here. So we're going to look at, first of all, the book of Exodus.
Exodus 23, verse 19.
So Exodus, yeah. Yeah, so 23:19. So it says, the verse is very, very specific. It says, Reshid bikure admatcha tavi bet Adonai Elohecha lo tevashel gedi b'chalav imo. Can you kindly translate that, please?
It says in Exodus 23:19, the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of Yehovah your Elohim. You shall not boil a young goat, in its mother's milk.
Mm-hmm. So that's one place. Mm-hmm. And then
the other one,
pulled this out. It's
34:26.
The other again.
Exodus 34:26.
Oh, so 34. So okay. So sorry, I was wrong. It's not in Leviticus. The other one appears again in the in Exodus. Again, where was it?
Exodus 34, verse 26. I do believe we're going there now. Yes, I've got it.
So it repeats. It says the same thing.
Yeah, it does. Word for word, okay, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then in Deuteronomy 14:21, it says, "Lo tochlu kol nevela lager asher bisharecha titena v'achala." תיתן ואחלה, או מחור לנוחי כי המקדוש אתה לאדמה אלוהיך, לא תבשל גדי בחלב אמו. So please translate that, the entire
verse. Verse 21, you shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is within your gates. Now there's a topic, y'all, but let me keep reading.
the alien?
I know. He may eat it. He may eat it. Or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a holy people. To Yehovah your Elohim, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk.
So if you're going to be a literalist and say, okay, it's literally a kid in its mother's milk, in what connotation that will be? Is it always only a kid in its mother's milk, or is it actually something very specific? So if anyone has ever heard of this place, I know what I'm talking about. There was a place called Ugarit, which was a gigantic city in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
Also known as Ras al-Shamra. And they discovered in the early 1900s, they discovered a gigantic city with texts. They found these slabs of clay, I think, uh-huh. if I'm not mistaken, which have writing on them, and these are religious texts. And amongst the religious texts, they find a very, very interesting phrase. I'm actually going to read this out from a book by Professor Kasuto, unfortunately, died at a very young age. I would say young age. He was only in his 50s, and he died about 50 years ago. And he mentions a very, very interesting particle, a very interesting statement in these books, in these clay things. And these are epic stories of Baal, which was, if everyone remembers, the name Baal appears a lot in the Tanakh. Baal was a deity in yes. Ugarit. Mm-hmm. He was actually a Canaanite deity. Mm-hmm. He is considered to be the son of El, which I've been asked about in the past. What does it mean, El? Well, El basically means God, but here they're saying the El, the God. He is the father of the gods. And if you actually study the text of Ugarit, you see that they attributed a lot of the names they gave their gods were also used in the Hebrew terms. So, yeah. For example, the word Rochev Aravot, which is given to the God of Israel, they would actually give Baal the name Rochev Arafot, very similar, just sort of a ver, there's a fur, mm-hmm. and that will also be the meaning. And they also were able to understand what that term means, because the word Arava, the Arava here in Israel is either a willow, mm-hmm. or the plain south of the Dead Sea. So they're trying to understand what does it mean. What does it mean? Rochev aravot. And when they discovered these texts, they realized rochev aravot means the word aravot here means clouds. So the rider of clouds.
Right.
Okay. So one of the things that Professor Kasuto, and I'm reading this out, I'm quoting from the book, the Goddess Anat, the epic story, the epic Canaanite stories from the times of the patriarchs. This is from page 40. This is in Hebrew, and he says that he actually connects the two. Ideas and puts them together. What he says here in one of the Ogredic texts, he calls it Shin Shin. I'm not exactly sure. If you want to, this is a bit of archaeology, so I'm going to be trying to be as precise as I can here. Shin Shin, in his terminology, would be there was a man called Viroli who created a list. So in Viroli, it's SS. And if it's in Golden's, there's a thing called the Ogredic Handbook or Textbook by a man called Golden. He actually can buy it off of Amazon.
Yes.
It's pretty expensive. It's like over $150. And in his countings, it's called 62. Okay, so it's on line 14, and it says, Tavach gadi b'chalav tale b'chima'a. And this is part of the fertility practices they had in Ugarit, in the Canaanites. And it has to do with the fertility of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look closely into the verses, specifically the verses in Exodus, it's directly connected to the Bikurim, which are the festivals of first fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know there's a whole confusion out there in the Messianic movement. When is first fruits? When is Shavuot? I can't really clarify that on one leg, but the idea is that the Bikurim, now, the first fruit you will bring will be the barley sheaf, but right. It's considered to be first fruits only 50 days afterwards when you actually start bringing the other grains and the actual fruits themselves.
Uh-huh.
So first fruit, what we usually call Chag HaBikurim, or first fruit, will actually be from the moment the Chag HaShavuot, the festival of weeks, from that point onwards, that will be considered first fruit, but that carries on all the way to Sukkot, all the way to the festival of booths. That's called Chag HaAsif.
Mm-hmm.
When you finish collecting everything from the land, and the Mishnah in the end of the tractate of there's a tractate called Bikurim talks about this, and it tells you begin from the festival of booths, from the festival of weeks, all the way to festival of booths,
yes.
Because there are different levels, different times of ripening.
Okay, and so
okay, so barley is the first to ripen, and then you have other fruits ripen different times throughout that time, but it all happens during the time of this beginning of summer.
Okay, and that is the context of the twice mentioned in Exodus, right?
Yeah, so it's a context of that. So you can connect it somewhat to the fertility practices, and what the Torah is telling you, when you've come to celebrate the fertility of your land, do not take the practices of the Canaanites.
Right.
Okay, now that's to do with Exodus, okay? But it repeats it again in the book of Deuteronomy, and it has nothing to do with it. It actually comes after a list of the things you're allowed to eat and not allowed to eat, and that's directly connected to what we were talking earlier about the kosher and unkosher animals.
Yes.
And I can also... Let
me get this right. So the two mentioned in Exodus are in the context of first fruits, but when we look at the verse in Deuteronomy 14, verse 21, it's devoid of the context of first fruits.
It's actually after the whole list of things which you're not allowed to eat.
Uh-huh.
So we can add another layer to this. And this is my opinion. If you're commenting on the Tanakh, my opinion is that it's actually saying not only that you're not allowed to do this, cook the kid's mother's milk, but also it's telling you not only necessarily to do with fertility practices, but also to do in everyday life, because this is still an imitation. This is a practice done by the pagans.
Sure.
And this is why the Torah is specifically talking about a kid and its mother's milk, and not saying meat and milk, which now we go into the issue of what the rabbis explain. So what is practiced in Orthodox Judaism is a very, very strict dietary law. Okay, I do suggest if anyone, people if anyone's really interested in this, they can watch Nehemiah's video about this.
Yes,
I don't know if he's ever done a recording, but you can watch the.
Yeah, the, it's, yeah called, it's called the Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus. It can be found on YouTube now. And it's just Nehemiah
Jordan.
Yeah, it's
been uploaded to YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. The Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus. And he talks about this in some in a reasonable amount of detail.
And a whole bunch of very interesting subjects, a lot of very interesting questions that have been raised by him when we were discussing, and there are things I don't have a clear answer on them. You know, being an Orthodox Jew, he asked very, very interesting questions, and there's some of them I can't really answer yet. So going to the issue of meat and milk. So the times of the rabbis, the times of the Pharisees specifically, they actually practiced that you know to have meat, but meat from four-legged animals, mm-hmm. which means ox, goat, and sheep. I can't really tell you about the flesh of wild animals, but my guess is at least up to a certain point, they actually did allow the flesh of wild animals with milk because it has nothing. You don't really eat the milk of four-legged animals. You can. I don't think it's very good for us as people. Cow's milk was also debatable for allowed to eat dairy products from cows. A lot of people actually eat goat milk, which is, by the way, a very, very good idea. I do suggest it. I'm trying to switch to goat milk. We have abundant quantities of goat milk around Israel, so that shouldn't be a problem. In most countries, you can buy it.
Yeah. We've got our own. We've got our own goats, and we milk our goats, and we love the milk.
So my only problem with goat is that everything smells of goat. The milk smells of goat. The flesh smells of goat. I even have tan hides here for a Torah scroll that comes from goat. It smells like goat. The smell seriously bothers me. Okay, so what is practice? So in the beginning, if we take, for example, the way Nehemiah looks at the verses, mm-hmm. I actually kind of agree with him to a certain degree that this is probably the original meaning. The only thing you're allowed to do is take a kid, a goat, a male goat, and cook it in some mother's milk. And it was offered to the pagan gods. And this is really what it means. So basically, by that opinion, you're allowed to eat a cheeseburger, and you're allowed to grate your Parmesan cheese on top of your bolognese, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of dishes. You know, for example, there's types of fried chicken where you have a coating and you put milk in the coating. Mm-hmm. Classic British thing. My family's from England. Yorkshire pudding.
Hey.
You make it with milk, uh-huh. and you serve it with a meat sauce or meat gravy. My mother, who comes from England, actually successfully developed a water-based version of it, which comes out perfect.
Yeah.
So there is people who want to separate meat from milk, there is a kosher version when you put instead of milk, you put water in.
Uh-huh.
Anything of that sort. So based on that idea, that's what you can do. Mm-hmm. But in the rabbinical opinion, at a certain point, they started saying, no, it's any meat and milk. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the translations, the Aramaic translation, it says basal b'halav. It says meat in milk. So in Jewish tradition, up to around, I think, the second century, they refrained from eating any four-legged animals, any farm animals, in milk, mm-hmm. in any milk, which means it doesn't mean
could be cream,
specifically
could be cheese,
in its mother's
could be,
milk.
Yeah, just any
exactly,
milk.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't. You don't have to mix it in. But birds, fowl, you're allowed to eat them. We were allowed to eat them.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a whole discussion of how. We'll get to that in a moment, actually. And in the second century, what happened was that they decided you're also not allowed to eat fowl with this. Now, we're not going to go to the discussion about adding and reducing from the Torah. This is another issue. Mm. You should watch Nehemiah's video. I think he makes a very convincing argument about this. Mm. Rabbis have been pondering about this. How can it be that we can add? And they say, well, we're not really adding. We're reinforcing the Torah, and that's basically the explanation. And they also say the Torah gave the rabbis or the elders the power to decide. It says "Kechol asher yorucha," as anything that they will command you. That appears in the book of Deuteronomy, mm-hmm. and it has to do with if there's any kiparim chadavar bedam bedam medin divrei vod vod bishalecha v'kamta valita l'makom asher yivchar adonai Elohecha uvat el kohanim el hashofet asher yehu b'yamim ahem. And then they give you a decree. How can it be? How can he add? They can also ask a very simple question about the book of Esther. How can it be that they added to the Book of Esther. How did they add the festival mentioned the Book of Esther? And actually, the Talmud does debate that. That actually has a discussion about that. That
it's talking about Purim, right?
Purim, exactly. Purim. They didn't in the beginning. They did not want to add Purim as a festival, and in time it was accepted, but it did take a very, very long while for anyone to accept that.
Really? That's interesting.
I'm not going to go into detail about this subject. We can talk about this another time. But they said, "Gechol Asher Yoruha," anything that they teach you or show you how to do, you have to go by that, not to turn to the right or left. Mm-hmm. And they say, "Oh, this means even if you know 100% that they're wrong, you're allowed. You have to do what they say." And this is the rabbinical understanding. And I'm telling you, there are things done in the Orthodox world which are sometimes ridiculous, but people say the rabbi said we do that. And this is how extreme it is.
Yeah.
And I have my own opinions about this. We can touch that another time. but they decided that you're not allowed to eat any bird in milk because they had free-range birds, and the flesh was darker. But anyone who knows what meat looks like and what four-legged meat looks like and what bird meat looks like knows this assumption.
Mm.
And it took a while until it was actually accepted. And even when it was accepted, the Talmud, and this is my opinion, I literally sat down with this for a very long while, up to around the 8th or 9th century, what mm-hmm. they refrained from doing is eating them together, meat and milk and bird and milk. They wouldn't eat them together, but it's a bit of an argument what the Talmud is actually talking about. But up to around the 8th century, people understood the Talmud was saying, you know, let's eat them together, but if you have your steak and then you want to have your ice cream, there shouldn't be no problem with that. Then came up a man called Rabbeinu Hananel around the 9th century, 8th or 9th century. I think it was 9th century, going into the 10th, actually. He started teaching that you have to keep time in between your meat and your milk.
And now this is imposed into, Genesis chapter 18?
Genesis chapter 18, you're referring to the issue with Abraham.
Yes.
So the rabbis tried to explain it. What went on there was that he first of all served them the butter, and then he served them the veal.
The veal, yeah. And so somewhere in between there was a lapse of time, right? Is what is imposed into the text.
So that's more midrashic, and I don't like dealing with midrashim too much because midrashim have strange ideas, interesting ideas. What I do suggest to people, if anyone wants to read an interesting argument about this, is to read the disputation in between Nachmanides and the Jewish convert, what was his name?
Pavlo Christiani,
where, by the way, in the Hebrew text, he's actually mentioned as actually a Paul. He's actually referred as Pere Paul, which is maybe, I'm talking, this is from the writings of Nachmanides. I actually have it in Hebrew at home, in the original language he wrote it in, and he wrote it specifically in Hebrew so other people around the Jewish world can be able to read it, because people lived in Spain, in Aragon, for example, which is in between France and Spain, if I'm not mistaken. But Jews lived all around the world, and they had to deal with Christians, and they had Christians in different places. So he wrote in Hebrew because it was an international language for Jews. And deals with that. And he says, you know, the you can't take the Midrashim literally as they are. And I know a lot of people in the Messianic movement love reading the Midrashim, but you have to be very careful what you're reading and saying, oh, but we found a Midrash that talks about, I'm going to step on people's toe, the Messiah doing XYZ, it's a midrash. It's not to be taken literally, and this is how it's taught how to correctly read midrashim.
Mm-hmm.
These are not things to be taken literally.
Sure.
So again, this is an interesting idea. This is a midrash brought by several rabbis, say in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th century, and this is how they used to teach in the synagogues. They would take something from the Torah, they will tell you a story about it and also give you a halakha, a law based on that story, and they will connect it because the majority of the people around them used to read the Torah or listen to the Torah once a week. There's a decree to read the Torah three times a week on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And but most of the people heard them used to go to the synagogue on Saturday because that's when they really had time. So they would barely listen to the Torah, and they mostly remember the stories. So to connect a halakha to the Torah in a way that people would be able to listen and remember, they would connect it to a story. And this is why you have this idea that they kept time. It is not to be taken literally. It does not mean that Abraham served these messengers in the word in Hebrew is malachim, which would mean messengers or angels. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean he actually separated meat from milk. But we reached a point where they started telling stories where the patriarchs, even before Torah was given, they kept the Torah. But that's a problem because the Torah, they actually do things the Torah says you're not allowed to do, for example, marrying sisters. Mm-hmm. They kept different commandments, for example, circumcision. They were loyal to God. They were sacrificed. They kept some kind of religious ritual reality, specifically sacrifices. And it seems clear that they actually sacrificed very, very specific animals. Remember, I mentioned in the issue of blood and fat, yes. I mentioned that Noah's commanded to bring also pure, tahol animals to the yes. to the ark, and so it seems that in the ancient world there was a clear tradition: what is tahol and what is tameh. And mm-hmm. this is why you would find this in other cultures around the world, where there are certain animals which would be considered impure or unedible. You know, to eat this animal is an animal which is it's a disgusting animal, mm-hmm. or it's an impure animal. So we know that they had these different traditions. So it was very clear they knew what a pure animal was. It was probably something understood, a global understanding, at least in Mesopotamia and the Near East and the Middle East. But it doesn't mean they actually kept the Torah. Mm-hmm. So going back to the issue of meat and milk, what's practiced today after this definition, this explanation by Rabbeinu Chananel, and this became mainstream, is you have to keep in between meat and milk time. You eat your steak, you have to wait time. Now, how much time depends on the explanation in the Talmud, where there's this person who describes himself that he's vinegar. I know vinegar in the ancient world was mostly made from wine that fermented. Mm-hmm. She says, I am vinegar, son of wine. My father used to keep an entire day. I keep from a meal to a meal, and usually in between meal to a meal was 6 hours. Nice. And they developed this idea that you're supposed to keep 6 hours. So you have in the Orthodox world two traditions. You have Jews who come from the Sephardic world of North Africa, Near East, and Spain that keep 6 hours. Uh-huh. German Jews who keep 3 hours because they say, well, in Germany we eat in between each meal. There's 3 hours. In Germany they had a different way of eating, so they kept 3 hours. Uh-huh. And that's, by the way, my family tradition.
Yes.
And the pure European, this is the early stage, the pure European opinion was to keep 1 hour. Okay, but when this was said, it wasn't talking about birds yet. It was talking about four-legged animals. Mm-hmm. And in time, people start keeping also from eating dairy immediately after eating chicken or anything of the soul. Uh-huh. So in the Orthodox world, we have that. There are people six, 3, or 1 hours. The only people who keep 1 hour are the Dutch uh-huh. Jews, uh-huh. But even they don't do that anymore because now it's now the practice by everyone. This is the way everyone should do it. And I completely disagree with this notion. If there's interpretation in the Talmud that says you can keep 1 hour and this is your family tradition, you shouldn't care what the other people are doing. This is a big argument I've been having for years with a lot of people, because people know I keep three hours, and they criticize me for this. I say, but listen, this is the opinion of the German Jews and this is the tradition of my family. You can't argue with this. You know, there's this idea that it's what we call the religious police. And you have that everywhere. You have that in almost every religion.
That's people
say, we're going to tell you what to do.
That's right.
What is that supposed to mean? It says this, we're going to do this. Why are you trying to add to things?
Yes.
And this is a big argument in the religious world. I'm not the only one. Lots and lots of people that argue this.
Wow.
So
it's a real point of contention in the Orthodox world. Not only the commandment is do not boil a kid in its mother's milk, but they extend that to mean not just a goat kid, but any meat you cannot boil in milk. Not only that, but you cannot eat any kind of milk product with any kind of meat product. Not only that, but you must wait a certain amount of time between eating these two things, and so on it goes. So obviously
and we're not done. Now, what we also have is this is something in the past 200 years, now even less, 150 years. And my father clearly states he remembers that they didn't always have different eating dishes, eating tools to eat their food. You had a plate, you had one set of plates, and uh-huh. my father grew up in the 50s in London. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. They were almost immediately after the Second World War, and people were still very poor, and they never separated.
Yeah.
And now you find separate utensils for meat and milk, aye. Separate tools. Many families have separate sinks.
Aye, aye, aye. Separate sinks.
The extreme. the most extreme thing that exists, and this is held by only the Hasidic Jews. Okay, Hasidic, you have to remember, there's a big confusion in the Messianic world. What is Hasidic?
Mm-hmm.
There's Orthodox, Ultra-Orthodox, and in the Ultra-Orthodox, not everyone is Hasidic. Okay, Hasidic is a very specific group of people that belong to a movement that was created about 300 years ago in Europe by the Baal Shem Tov. He didn't really start the movement. He was like one of the founders of the movement. And these are called Hasidim. Usually can recognize them. They wear these funny clothes. They have these like really high stockings sometimes. They have the peot, the side locks. And they belong to a Hasidic group. And you have to be very, very specific, because if you walk up to a Lithuanian Jew like me, or a Litvak, from Lithuania, but usually people who are not Hasidic are called Litvaks or Lithuanians, and you call them a Hasidic Jew, their son has become insulted. You can actually insult them by saying that. Because this is a big argument. Because the Hasidic group is like, they developed these strange ideas about Judaism which did not really fit Judaism as it should be. They were very loose about certain things. It was a whole mess. If you want to go into the history of Hasidic Judaism, we can do a program about that.
But you were saying they have an extreme...
They would have... This is the most extreme. They have a separate fridge. They have separate towel sets.
Wow.
And sometimes, and there are cases where they would have completely separate counters, like a huge kitchen divided into two separate areas.
Wow, you're freaking me out.
That is the most extreme.
Are you serious?
I am very, very serious. And...
wow!
I actually went to my rabbi once, and he's a Litvish rabbi, and I asked him about this, and he said, "You got only one sink in your house? Whatever." I told him, "Can I put the same plates and everything in the same, you know, dairy plates and meat plates?" And he said, "You can do it. Don't worry. There is no law in the Torah. There is no law anywhere in the Talmud. Yep. There is no law by any sage that says you have to separate to that degree." And he said, "It's even more than that. I am upset with people who separate to that degree."
Man,
and we had a whole discussion about this. It's ridiculous. He said,
"It's incredible." It's incredible. Okay, so now, coming back from that, I mean, that blows my mind, Yol. But coming back from that, your personal opinion, having studied the text, is that what it means is, do not boil a kid in its mother's milk. If someone has dairy with their meat, that's not going to concern you a great deal.
But I would not be offended if I sit with someone, say I meet up with a friend of mine, and he eats a cheeseburger. I am not going to say anything.
Okay.
I am not going to criticize them. I'm not going to say anything, because there is historical proof and linguistic proof that the Torah is talking about kid in its mother's milk in the context of the pagan practice. I personally, at home, we separate, we don't eat them together, but when it comes to the issue of time in between meat and milk, I go by the strict Talmudic explanation, the original explanation, which means just don't eat them together.
Okay.
And I'm actually known for doing this in my community. And a lot of people are upset with me, but I do this, and I'm very clear about this. I have my conviction about this.
Sure.
I've shown it to people. I've explained it to people, and a lot of people were convinced. They just say, we don't want to go outside of the square that we live in.
And isn't there? I mean, we spoke about that last time, really, when it came to tradition, and how long it takes to sort of overcome that when it comes to dietary laws. Boy, oh boy.
Exactly.
That blows my mind. But,
by the way, this is a major divider in between different groups inside religious Judaism, because also you have different slaughterhouses, and each slaughterhouse, each rabbinical group that has its own slaughter doesn't trust the other one. Each group has different slaughter, doesn't trust the other one. And this is why, for example, you go in and there are different certificates, and someone will walk in and will buy a very, very specific kosher certificate because this is the one he trusts.
Wow.
So, and I'm going to mention something that's going to surprise a lot of people. It's a surprise coming from me specifically. But if you take, for example, the writings of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a subject which appears in the writings of Paul, where he talks about the animals you're allowed to eat and not allowed to eat, and keeping away from certain people. I can't say exactly where it is. I'm not a New Testament scholar. I'm just mentioning something I read before.
Yeah.
But I think it appears in the book of Acts, I think. And they talk about this issue. And some people, first of all, some people try to say you know, Paul, what Paul is saying is that everything is allowed. But I don't think that's what Paul is saying. I think what Paul is saying is that, actually, no, don't refrain yourself from going eating with someone who is not part of your belief. Now, here's an example, and I told myself I'll never talk about these subjects, but here's a general idea.
Yes.
For example, take the story of Jesus when he goes to Capri.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he is told, and again, I'm not a Messianic teacher, I'm not anything.
I just know
these stories because I have Messianic friends and I've heard stories and I know ideas. And for example, he goes to Capri, and he goes to these fishermen. And some of these fishermen become his disciples. And I think the story goes like this, that there's a money collector, a tax collector
yes.
called, I think that might be the famous Matthew, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't really know much about the New Testament. And he's a tax collector. And he goes to the fisherman's house, and he's sitting there, and everyone's coming in, and they'll save me, teach me, heal me, etc. The money changer hears that they had, they were able to fish, and they caught a huge amount of fishermen. He says, "Oh, so he probably has a lot of money." And again, also one of the reasons I know this story is because I actually watched in the past the miniseries called Jesus of Nazareth. So there's a few bits and pieces I know.
Okay.
So if I'm describing this in the wrong way, I do apologize to everyone out there. And he comes and he wants to see who is this Jesus of Nazareth, or in the way Messianics would say it, Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes in and he says, "Do you live far away?" And he says, "No." He says, "I would like to eat supper with you." And they all look at him and say, "What do you mean eat supper with him? He's a tax collector. He's an evil person. The rabbis decreed anyone who comes in contact with him and anyone who goes to his house would be contaminated." But this is part of the issue. The dietary laws, the excommunication was also based on the issue of not eating with that person, considering his food to be defiled, to consider his touch to be impure.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, this is what Paul is actually talking about. He's actually saying, don't refrain yourselves from going. You know, he's saying we as the believers in Jesus, he was basically saying don't turn yourself into a sect. Don't put yourself aside from the rest of the people.
Okay? Sure.
And I'm saying, how do I know that this is what he's saying? Because even today, the food issue is a major issue in the Jewish world. You know, when you go into someone's house and you don't know what they practice, there will be many people that will not eat. And I actually know there's, you know, if you go to a house of a secular Jew,
yep.
You know, usually a person would ask, "Can I have a glass of water?" And that's all they'll ask for.
And that's all they'll have, yeah.
Because that's all they'll have, because they don't know if they can trust them. And even if the person says, "Well, I separate meat from milk," he's still going to say, "No, it's okay, just give me a disposable cup with water and that'll be fine."
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people do, and so this is why Paul mentions, he says, don't refrain from eating them. You can eat anything, but he's not saying don't, you know, you're allowed to eat whatever. He's going,
yeah,
eat shrimps,
yeah. Well, actually,
go have your shrimps with your sauce.
That's not what he's saying. But absolutely, that's not what he's saying. But there's the example in Galatians where Paul says, you know, I really got up Peter because Peter, he was separating from the Gentiles to eat with the Jews. And I said to him, "Come on, man! You know, don't." And it says, "I opposed him to his face." So there's another example of that as well. I would agree. Yeah.
So again, the issue of separation, specifically in food, is still to this very day a major thing in Judaism.
Yeah.
And this is why a lot of Jews, you know, they make sure that if they're going somewhere, they're not too sure if they're gonna have any food there, or if they're going on a flight. I mean, I have a friend who flies. Every year he works in the United States, uh-huh. And he actually takes food with him onto the plane.
So he has his own kosher food because
he doesn't trust his own
kosher food. Okay. Even though you can, I mean, I know you can request kosher food on the plane, but to be absolutely confident, exactly. He takes his own.
So I actually do the opposite. When I go to a family and they want to serve food, you know, I eat like specific things, kosher certificates at home, but if I go to someone else's house, I consider it to be rude. If someone offers you food, and this is a Mediterranean culture, if someone offers you food, you say yes.
Yeah.
So I have I have secular friends, and they, if they know I'm coming, they go out and they buy, they make sure it's kosher.
Yes.
And unless it's not kosher and they serve it to me, I say, okay, fine, and I eat it. Mm-hmm. I don't say anything about it. No, yeah. I ate. That's it.
That's great, and that's great. And I would agree. Obviously, if they offer you a lobster, you're not going to have it. But they wouldn't do that. Friends of yours, they know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. But what you are saying is that there are incredible extremities when it comes to and a great deal of difference between what is solely written in the Tanakh, what is solely written in Torah, and the actual practice of Orthodox Judaism. And the extremities that can actually go to when it comes to kosher. That's amazing.
Exactly. So,
boy, oh boy.
I think we covered everything in kosher.
I think we better leave it there because we're going to – you know what? I don't think you could possibly cover absolutely everything in kosher, and I reckon if we digged a little deeper, we'd find something else to spend a half hour on, and we better not do that. Oh, hang on. One more thing.
Okay. We've spoken. You're going to cut this into two shows, right?
I'm cutting this into two or three or four shows. Remember, we mentioned Nehemiah Gordon. Now he may pretend that he doesn't remember this conversation, but you can remind him when he comes back from the States. He did say he was thinking about it because, of course, the grasshoppers, right? Grasshoppers, locusts, they're kosher. They're food. He's never had one. He said he might. Eat one live on the radio.
So I told him when he does that to call me because I also want to actually see it with my
own eyes. You can be the second witness, and we'll remind him when he comes back. We have to find a kosher grasshopper, a locust, something that he can eat. He's going to try one for the first time.
Grasshopper. It's not grasshopper. It's a type of locust.
Okay.
There actually is a list by Zohar Amal of the kosher locust.
All right.
The Torah mentions four different types of locusts. The Yemenites have a tradition of what these kosher animals are, these kosher locusts are.
Yep.
Zohar Amal specifically is also, I think he's half Yemenite. Mm-hmm. I think he's half Yemenite from his father's side. But this is considered to be famine food. This is why the tradition kind of vanished.
Have you ever eaten one?
No, I have not eaten one.
Okay.
I have been offered to eat. I have been offered to go out hunting for these things. but really, these are animals that are eaten for today. It's famine food. Remember, I mentioned the dormouse. You know, in Rome, they used to eat dormouse.
Yeah.
In the past, they ate anything that would have protein or anything you can eat. So they're eating insects is not not something unusual for the ancient world. It's just
this is
very obscure. And the Torah gives you like specific insects which are kosher, which would be types of locusts. And we do have to check this thing out. I think I'll be glad to be with Nehemiah at that given moment when he tries to eat that thing. He actually asked me if I have recipes.
Hey, there you go. And
he actually asked me if I have recipes, and I said there are not too many recipes.
There's a pizza place in South Australia, y'all. There's a pizza place that has locust pizza.
I'm not surprised. I've also seen worm pizza.
Ooh. And
cockroach pizza.
We're not getting back into that. Okay, that's
There are people who eat anything, and I specifically know it comes from Australia. Some of the stuff.
The locust might be really tasty. I don't know. I've never tried it either. But Nehemiah.
I've actually asked Yemenite friends of mine who were in Israel in the 50s, people who were elderly now in their 70s, 80s, and I asked them, so what does it taste like? And they say, well, usually we roast them. We used to take them, throw them in the oven, and roast them, and eat them like snacks, you know, like something crunchy you would eat.
Nice.
And sometimes they would dip them in chilbe, which is this spicy thing. It looks like a jello. Type of thing. They're like it's in Yemen. They were the only ones who really, really kept a clear tradition about these things.
Did they like?
But there are not too many recipes. So they said they liked them. One of them described to me when he was like 12 or 13. I mean, he should be in his 80s now.
Yeah.
He described to me that when in school, they would actually go to school with they used to go to the playfield and they come with these brown paper bags. With the locust, and they would sit there and eat them while watching a game or something, and the the European Jews who knew they were wrong. What are you eating? What are you eating? They should take out this thing. And what you do is you remove the head, yeah, the wings, and the legs, and you, yeah, eat only the actual body itself. And they would show them and ask, what is it? Locust. Locust. And they'll just go, yuck.
All right, all right. Well, anyhow, when he gets back, let's see if we can find one. Maybe you can come up with a recipe. Maybe we can get Nehemiah Gordon to eat locusts live on the radio. You can be a witness to that. I'm sure everybody would appreciate it. But until then, I think we have covered pretty much almost everything when it comes to kosher. What do you think?
I think we've covered the main issues, the main subjects based on the Torah. There are probably a lot of Talmudic things which are irrelevant for people who want to follow specifically the Torah. If there are any questions, again, people can put on the comments. If there are any questions, people have asked questions, for example, about the tail fat.
Yes.
And I'll be glad to answer them. I usually sometimes go into this go into the website and answer these questions. The only thing is I'm asking people not to send me emails.
Okay, so if you have any questions or comments in regards to the program on kosher, please don't send those comments or questions to Yoel on the email. Leave them in the comments section on the website of truthtoyou.org, and he will certainly address them there. But if you are interested in Hebrew lessons, quality Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, I can highly recommend him. The email for that is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. That's HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Yoel, thank you so much, my friend, for giving us so much of your time and knowledge in regards to kosher. I think we've pretty much exhausted it.
Yes, I think we have.
I think we have.
And now that we covered all the kosher subjects, if there are any other subjects that people out there want to hear about,
let us know.
Let us know and we'll try. I mean, there are things I don't have enough knowledge about, but there are things that we can try to talk about, or things I actually do know how to explain.
Yeah. And happy to explore. Happy to explore. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Brilliant.
So I hope, again, as I said last time, I hope this helps out people. The purpose is to follow the Torah, and God willing, we'll have more subjects and more topics to talk about. Besides that, have a great week, everyone, and enjoy your food, your kosher food.
Enjoy your kosher food. In the meantime, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of the Father's word. Shalom.